Hello, I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gowan.
And this is the Love Letter Squad.
Yes, we are, and we welcome you to another evening of Love Letters Live, where we bring you a wonderful guest, a story or two, and a love letter to follow. We are primarily a radio program about love and gratitude. Love letters to anyone for any reason at any time. Love letters to people no longer here. Love letters to people unborn. It doesn't really matter because you, as the letter writer, are the boss and in charge. So I want to go to our guest right now. Frederick Hertz is an attorney, a mediator, and an author based in Oakland. And Frederick, this book is out or coming out?
Came out just last fall.
It's called Making It Legal, and it is a guide to same-sex marriage, domestic partnership, and civil unions. And I'm just going to go right to you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do in your law practice, if it's related, and a little bit about this book?
Sure. What I do in my work, both as a lawyer and a mediator, is I work on both the formation and dissolution of love relationships. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they are also friendship relationships, but I mostly work with couples who are either forming their relationships or dissolving them. I work as a mediator and an attorney, and I mostly work on the issues of money and property.
When it comes time for dissolution, you mean?
And formation. I do prenups.
Yes, of course.
I do prenups for unmarried couples, mm-hmm. both gay and straight. Mm-hmm. And now I work with same-sex and opposite-sex couples, both gay and straight thus. And I write books for Nolo Press, which is a publisher that focuses on empowering individuals to get things done without lawyers. And I'm the author of both the Living Together book, which is a legal guide for unmarried straight couples, mm-hmm. and the Lesbian and Gay Legal Guide, which is a comprehensive guide. And then our new book is just on the issues of marriage and domestic partnership for same-sex couples.
That's this Making It Legal?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's my sister refers to it as my entering my Dear Abby phase.
Oh, good.
Because I actually have a section on is your partner marriage material and are you?
You know, that's so important.
Absolutely.
This whole Dear Abby, people need instruction and help and guidance and a light shining on what they should look for.
Yes. Well, one of the things that has come up within the gay community is that where partnerships didn't have legal recognition, they also didn't come with legal obligations.
Oh.
And so I'm doing a lot of work educating the gay and lesbian community that the right to marry brings with it obligations. And so questions about money and property and debt and obligation and personal responsibility start to play a role in a way that straight spouses have been thinking for years. Now gay and lesbian spouses,
as much as they think,
well,
when they're decided to get married,
yes,
they do.
They can always do a better job.
Right.
But I do a lot of work as a mediator with couples in conflict, again, both married and unmarried, both gay and straight, and that's really my emphasis, which is trying to help couples unpack and unravel things when they've gone awry.
And you say that with such a respectful, kind of loving attitude, that you're not seeing an end of a relationship as necessarily a failure, but something that needs to be unpacked. I like that.
Yes. Well, as many of my therapist friends say, the end of a relationship or a breakup is not what happens after the relationship is over. It's actually the last chapter of the relationship.
Oh, sure.
And that's the attitude I try to bring, and to acknowledge that for certain relationships, moving on is actually the better choice.
Yes, of course.
And so what I try to work with is helping couples move on with the least amount of harm, the least amount of damage, emotionally as well as financially.
So what are some of the most difficult, if you could just pick a couple to tell us about and illustrate what these chores are like for you?
Well, the first problem is that when couples are angry at each other, making practical decisions becomes very hard because it's embedded in an emotional drama. So, for example, I'm doing a lot of now what I call foreclosure divorces, where they are both breaking up and they're losing their house in foreclosure because of bad financial decisions. And where,
so could you pick a couple, I mean, obviously,
sure,
without giving names, tell us specifics so we can understand.
Sure. Bill and Sally broke up. They bought a house at the top of the market. They have a second loan that they took out because of excess credit card spending. Now they're breaking up. Sally actually wants to try to keep the house, but she thinks that because most of the credit card debt was run up by Bill, he should pay off the second line of credit. And thus, if he did that, she could actually keep the house.
And so what do you say? What's your position?
And he says, I don't care. My debt is so big. My credit is so bad. I want to lose it to foreclosure. So what I try to do is first help them understand how they got into the situation. So part of it in this situation would be helping Sally to understand that she actually consented to letting the line of credit be taken out.
Oh.
She is not a drive-by victim of Bill. She chose him. She decided to take out the credit line. And so to simply blame him really is in conflict with the history of what happened.
And does that help Sally, or is she now mad at you?
Can I say both?
Yeah, sure.
She's both mad at me and it helps.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, because I'm speaking the truth that they're having trouble seeing.
Uh-huh. Well, I have a question. Are you seeing a relationship between the current economic environment and breakups like this?
Oh, totally. In two ways. One is couples in conflict make bad economic decisions. And, for example, the simplest one is if one person wants to spend a lot of money or renovate the kitchen and the couple is in good shape and they're planning their future and they have their kids, they can actually say, let's wait a few years.
Oh.
But if they have been fighting about everything, it's very common for one to just say, oh, I don't want to deal with him. Let him go do it.
Is there another issue, though? I heard, this was kind of a wisdom of many, many years ago, that people in crisis marriages that are really just about or should be at an end will sometimes take on a household project.
Totally.
So they'll have something to share and lose themselves in that. And then, of course, once the den is added on, they're done anyway.
But totally. So it does happen. And then, of course, the other issue, and I've been doing a lot of mediations, seems particularly painful when it's the husband who loses the job, but where one has lost the job, and so his emotional state starts to unravel. They've had a marriage that has depended on his being a certain role.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of relationships that don't do well in the troubled times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's also a lot of blame.
Is there any aspect, I also heard not too long ago, that the divorce rate is somewhat down because people simply can't afford to get divorced and maintain two homes and pay lawyers' fees?
That is true. I have worked with a number of couples for whom I'm doing cohabitation agreements, because they're actually staying together in the same household, dealing with issues like who's going to pay what, who is going to share the house.
So a whole new field in a way.
Absolutely.
Post-dissolution
cohabitation.
My goodness.
But going to the question about the love and the money, the thing that I do believe actually helps is if folks can understand how they got into the mess in a less blaming way, and mm-hmm. how they participated in, whether it's the emotional mess or the financial mess, that can usually, not always, but usually free people up to then make hard decisions, which might mean, in the case of Sally and Bill, actually, it has led them to cooperate on a short sale. And Sally has actually decided she can't afford to keep the house, but they're trying to salvage their credit rating with a short sale. But at least once she stopped blaming Bill mm-hmm. for the situation, Bill became a lot more cooperative and now has agreed to her choice of real estate agent, and they're actually selling the house, and they're going to try to minimize the damage because they were able to make a decision as a team as opposed to being locked into the blame.
So that you get to really take the role of a peacemaker as well as dissolution.
Yes.
Professional.
And what I try to do is achieve enough peace that people can make decent decisions. Let's call it Barb and Betty, a lesbian couple. They bought a second house to try to deal with their unhappiness by having a fancier house. Then when they were going to sell the first house, Barb wanted to take a certain price. Betty said, oh, we can do better than that. Mm-hmm. They spurned the $900,000 mm-hmm. offer. It's too late. It's too low. And now, of course, they look back on it fondly. And so now they have two houses. One is going into foreclosure. The other one isn't. Barb blames Betty for not letting the sale in, and with some legitimate concern. And now the problem is One of them wants to file bankruptcy, the other one doesn't. But again, they are so locked into the blame of each other that they're not able to deal with the present and the future because they're so focused on wanting to assess blame for the past.
And so as long as they're doing that, they're locked together for longer, aren't they?
Right. The metaphor I always give, if you spend all your time looking behind you, you're not going to notice the brick walls you're smashing into in front
yes,
of you.
Yes, right.
So what I try to do is get couples to spend enough time dealing with the past to be able to turn towards the future and the present.
And also there's something to be said, I would guess. You tell me if this is what you think. I'm kind of... That if the sooner they can stop this blame, the sooner they can help in a healthy way dissolve the marriage and move on with their lives.
Yes. I once said to a client, she said, I'm going to remind you of this if you ever break up. When she was going on and on about her ex and doing all this blame, I said, you know, it's not as though this person hit you in an intersection. You chose them.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to see that you were a part of this mess. She was very cute. She said, if your boyfriend ever dumps you, I'm calling you and telling you that. But it actually was helpful because I was able to see that. And the part that I, in an ideal world, if I could really, you know, run the world, I actually want people to not only stop blaming each other, but appreciate in a loving way the benefit they actually got in the good times.
Exactly. They chose each other probably for some reasons of good.
Yes.
And didn't see the red flags or the... So would you like to get a hold of people before they get married and help them see things clearly?
Well, yes. In an ideal world, what I like to do is work with couples around issues of money and property. And we talk a lot about this in the book because it has to do with what your values are, what your goals are, what your expectations of the other person really will be. And what I find is for most couples, they don't understand themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's about ambition, whether it's about debt, whether it's about children, whether it's about politics, or even whether it's about the connection to the extended family, a lot of people don't really understand their own needs and wants. And they don't know how to broker that. And so what I find, in fact, it's one of the best benefits of a prenup is it actually forces you to deal with issues like, do you expect your partner to rescue you? Mm-hmm. Do you expect to have a
in the hands of a really intelligent, emotionally intelligent attorney? It would be helpful. I don't know that everybody does it that way.
Oh, thank you for this is the label I want to have.
Okay,
on my
good.
Business card is the emotionally intelligent attorney.
Well, you sound like it.
And I actually do a lot of trainings for lawyers to get them to be, because a lot of lawyers think, oh, it's just about business, it's just about negotiating, and you don't have to deal with this stuff. Yes, actually, the hardest thing that it comes up in the prenup is I actually have worked with couples who have broken up in that process. And in retrospect, it was the right thing, but it's painful to watch. Mm-hmm. Especially, I do a lot of work with couples who have been unmarried and now are getting married. And, again, whether gay or straight, that often puts pressures on them to think about their relationship in a new way. And that can be especially difficult because, as I've said in one setting, it's like buying the car you've already been leasing. You kind of know the person already. But it's actually the best kind of prenup to do because then you really do know your own tensions and issues.
Although I must say, you know, you sometimes see relationships that people have been living together for several years and then get married and it's, you know, kablooey. Because people can be on good behavior for a very long time.
Yes, and once they've gotten married, they relax. The other is, the other part, which is, meaningful and not to be trivialized, is that beyond the legal issues, the societal notion of what it means to be married does raise people's expectations, and so they expect a kind of understanding and cooperativeness that doesn't always exist.
So talk about, you'd mentioned earlier, the love letters you think these people should have written. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, what I would like, even in the hardest of times, and I actually do sometimes get people to do this, but
good
it's very rare, is to be able to say, think back about what you were feeling when you bought that house, when you had that child, when you took that vacation. Think about the trust and the affection that you gave to that other person and the joy you got from him or her. And can you find any of that now and tap that in your making these decisions about, I am leaving, I am moving on, we are selling the house? Can you do that in a way that honors that love?
Okay.
So the love letter I would love my clients to write is perhaps a memory of a love, not a current feeling of love.
Oh, you are such a man after our own hearts. Yes.
See, the memory of the love and to actually wish the other person well.
Yes.
I also tell people, I mean, I have wonderful relationships with my two former partners. I joke because one of them has a much better memory of my past than I do. So, like, I can call him up and I'll say, do we ever know this person? I'll say, yeah, don't you remember we had that dinner and we had that big fight?
Yeah.
And, you know, because he has a better memory of my 20s than I do. But there's something so precious about having that connection to people you were close to a long time ago. And I say that, and this is one of the reasons that things I talk about with prenups, is the purpose of a prenup is to actually design the exit in a loving way so that if things go awry, you will end your relationship with the spirit of love that you had at the beginning.
And hope that you never do. And as a friend of mine who's an attorney once said, just do it, get the prenup done, put it in the vault, and go back to the business of loving.
I actually go even further.
Well,
I think doing the prenup strengthens the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's a model for how to deal with differences. It's a model of how to deal with expectations and disappointment.
How nice. Okay.
And so I try to use it even in my own life.
Good.
So the prenup is something that you have not in a vault locked away, but you might have it on the shelf or in the drawer.
To look at it again.
To look at it whenever you're having some minor tiff, you could pull it out. And
well, actually, it's not the agreement that you want to keep. It's the skills and the attitude mm-hmm. you brought to the agreement process.
Mm-hmm.
So that when 10 years later you're having children or one of you inherits money and the issue is whether it's going to be shared or not,
mm-hmm.
or one of you has a business crisis and you're trying to decide what to do, or even the routine decisions about where to spend money that you think about how you resolve things in the prenup process, and you invoke that. So it's more the process than the actual literal
agreement. So is that process written down? I mean, I have never seen a prenuptial agreement, but I'm guessing it's quite legal. It's all in legalese. And
the process is in the memory of the people who went through it.
Okay. But there's no triggers to that memory of what...
That's a good question. I sometimes have done prenups where people actually envision a review process or a decision process. But I would just say that usually it does actually imprint a way of dealing with things in a conscious way that is very, very helpful.
Good. Thank you. So now that's for the people you're dealing with that have difficulty in relationships. Do we have time to talk about, Teresa, do we have time for, good, let's talk about your parents.
Well, this was very poignant because I just spent the weekend with my parents to commemorate their 66.
Excuse me, as the opposite of people in trouble. Yeah.
Well, no, actually, they've had a high conflict marriage.
Okay.
So, in fact, I jokingly said once I was going to write, the next book was going to be called Everything I Know I Learned From, and as opposed to my parents, it was going to have a little insert that mm-hmm. said Dealing With My Parents.
Mm-hmm.
My parents celebrated their 66th anniversary of a high conflict marriage.
Okay, tell us how that was successful then.
A very affectionate one. Well, the story I told at their anniversary this time was my first memory of politics, which is that my father had a Goldwater bumper sticker in 1964, and my mother had a Lyndon Johnson bumper sticker. And I swear I remember one of them scratching the bumper sticker off the other one's car. That was sort of politics. And it ranged from we were going out to dinner, and my mother was arguing with my father about what he was going to wear to the dinner. And I turned to my mother and I said, look, he's alive. He's able to show up for dinner. What does it matter that what he wears? It was great. My father said, oh, it's great to have a son who's a lawyer. He loved that. But they...
Well, what did you respond to that?
She smiled.
Oh, okay.
It was sweet, and we went on. And
okay,
he just wore his unfancy jacket, and everything was fine. They regularly disagreed about lots of things. We had some years that were quite intense, whether it was about who I was living with or who my sister was living with or what my mother was doing. And they regularly disagreed. And about once every 10 years, they would come to a period of just about having a breakup.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They actually did break up once for a while. And they remained loyal and affectionate.
We'll talk about that. What brought them back together during a breakup? What made them stay with each other, do you think?
Well, I'd say two things. One is there truly was a sense of unconditional love.
How nice.
That they both would remember even when things were going poorly. And they would express that. And I think they realized that that fundamental core of unconditional love that they had with each other could be rediscovered, and that the issues that were driving them apart were small in comparison to that.
So it sounds like what you take to your clients, you kind of learn firsthand.
I do. Because one of the things that they taught us as children, actually, and this I think is really significant, my sister is 40 years with her husband, my brother is 34 years with his wife, my partner and I have been together 28 years. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Right.
I think that what's striking, and because we've had parent-child conflicts, is the intimacy was never at question.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they might be mad at you, they might be mad at each other, but we pay attention to each other. There is also, everything is forgivable. There is no act or wrong that was unforgivable. And, you know, there were times that I think all five of us did some pretty unforgivable things. But, you know, even when my father had problems with who I was living with, even when my sister had conflicts, even when they had conflicts with each other, the steady state was to reconnect. Even when my father had a lot of conflicts with me, his instinct was, I'm sending you a plane ticket. I want you to come here this weekend so we can work them out.
Oh, how nice.
And that was a spirit that they brought to their own conflicts. And I think they taught me that even when you're hurt, even when things aren't going your way, you don't abandon the person. If there is a deep fundamental love and appreciation, you work through that problem. You don't pretend it doesn't happen. I mean, I jokingly said once that the definition of a secret in my family is you wait 5 minutes before you tell someone. You know, and you know, whenever we could always tell. I mean, my mother would say things, and you know, within a half an hour I'd get a call from my sister saying, oh, they're at it again, they're having another conflict, and the whole family would rally around, and I would call my dad and we'd talk about what happened, and then sometimes, you know, my mother would go on a little vacation, and but we worked
never gave up
to reconnect.
Yes.
Even when there were issues, and we don't deny that the issues are there.
Right. So
the family unit is really important to you.
Well, I want to say something slightly different. No, it's the individual connections. Family unit sounds like you sit there silently and you line up and you obey. It really is the personal warmth and so you don't suppress the conflict in the interest of the family unit.
Mm-hmm.
You actually restitch the individuals and then the unit results from it.
Right.
But you can't just say, you know, change your behavior just for the sake of the family.
Uh-huh.
It has to be the personal one-on-one connection.
So are now your parents are both still with us?
Well, they're in another state, but yes,
they're alive.
They're quite alive.
Okay, so I have a question because this is about love letters. Did you bring one to share with us, or are we going to write one?
I guess I need to write one because
okay.
I didn't bring one with me.
Okay, I like that. I mean, either way is good, but we just have a few minutes, and I've been taking some notes just in the last couple of seconds because every once in a while I just love playing secretary.
Okay.
I don't want you to forget these things you said, which probably you wouldn't. But so who would get your love letter?
Well, at this point, I would write a love letter to my parents.
I think so. Because if you don't, I will.
Because then I would thank them
yes.
for teaching me about loyalty amidst yes. conflict.
Yes.
And to teach me about a way of staying connected over time and of valuing the other person and understanding them. And I would thank them for teaching me the skills and the attitude that has enabled me to flourish in my work.
Okay. Now, have you ever written to them before?
Oh, I write to them a lot.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, but love letters, because there's a difference between writing and writing love letters.
I have written loving cards,
mm-hmm.
sure, on anniversaries. And just on Saturday night, we all, my brother and sister and I, all stood up and we kind of recited a love letter to our parents.
Wonderful.
In front of 25 of their friends and relatives.
And do they have a copy of it in your handwriting?
No.
Okay. So this is going to serve a couple of extra things. You said on occasions you do it, and we say if you think you have to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, please remember that writing a love letter is a special occasion.
Well, having just spent the weekend with them...
I'm going to give you this note.
That is the occasion.
Yes.
Is the thoughts I had
right.
after spending the weekend with them.
Yes.
And that will be the special event.
In your own handwriting?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because, you know, when and you say they live elsewhere, they live in another state.
Yes.
When they get a letter that has felt the touch of your hand... And maybe you hold it, you know, before you slip it
right.
into them. And they're touching something that you've touched. It's really holding hands across time and distance.
Funny you say that. Whenever I counsel couples and individuals,
mm-hmm.
when they're trying to write difficult things,
mm-hmm.
I always say, put down your computer and write it by hand.
Yes.
Because that will remind the other person that there's a human being.
Oh, exactly. The there. Proof that someone was there. Anybody
Absolutely.
Can, anybody can sign your name to an email and hack your...
Uh-huh. So I completely honor that approach.
Okay, I'm so glad. This is a moment where we can retire. To
yes.
somebody else.
Yeah, we're
it.
Hoping that someday we
okay.
will. And if we're successful, we will.
Yes, but not soon because we're having too much fun. Okay.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for coming to do this with us and for covering so much valuable ground.
Right. Well, thanks for asking such good questions and for caring about this issue so much.
Teresa, are you going to give the website?
Yes, so just okay. as a reminder, this is the book is Thinking of Making It Legal.
Of Making It Legal.
Of Making It Legal. I need to put
my glasses.
Oh, yes.
The book is called Making It Legal.
Making It Legal. And A Guide to Same-Sex Marriages, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. And just quickly, would anyone benefit from reading this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this book is written for same-sex couples or those who have friends, relatives, or clients who are themselves gay or lesbian. And my straight friends tell me it's good for them,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I was going to say, there has to be...
This might be required reading for all 18-year-olds.
Right. So it's got to have lessons. Lessons for one is lessons for everybody.
Absolutely.
If they're valuable.
Yeah. Great. And the author is Frederick Hertz. And just...
The website is makingitlegal.net.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have to sign off because time is over, but we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. Please join us every week at this time. And we encourage you to put your loving thoughts into words and sending them while you still have the chance.
Yes.
So till next time, from Teresa
and Janet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.